Okay, so tell me why the music stopped abruptly there for a second. I can't figure it out either. Hey, everybody, it's October 22nd, 2020. My name is Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thank you for being here today or whatever day you're listening to the show. Perhaps on our archives, we archive the shows over at ace-ed.org. That's ACE-ED.org. You see a big icon there for podcasts because that's the site of our American Consortium for Equity in Education, ACE-ED.org. Education Talk Radio is under that umbrella, so to speak, and we want you to be part of that umbrella. Join with us in our never-ending fight for equity all over the country in education. It's free to educators. You go over there, you'll see all the podcasts. You'll see also our magazine. It's an online journal called Equity in Access. You can flip right through again. It's ace-ed.org, the American Consortium for Equity in Education. And we tweet over at EduTalk Radio and Facebook at my name, Larry Jacobs, and also at Education Talk Radio, and then link in over at my name, Larry Jacobs. We got a nice show for you today. I've got Dr. Isaiah Pickens, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, a well-regarded speaker, and founder of Eye-Opening Enterprises, which is a mental health and wellness education company that helps schools adapt classroom practices to ensure trauma-informed and culturally responsive, and that's key, what we're going to be talking about today, approaches that can be employed for all students, and that's key these days. I don't have to tell you what's going on out there regarding COVID, remote learning. Boston just yesterday, to put the show into perspective, announced that they're not going to go back to school at all. They're just going to stay closed, okay, and it's going to be completely remote learning. This matters, and in a big city like Boston, using them as an example, there's a lot of kids who are very needy out there, and a lot of African-American kids and Latino kids where this COVID is really striking, okay, their families and friends and relatives, and there's a lot of deaths in those communities. So we got to be really careful. So on that happy note, let me bring on a very happy guy, actually, Dr. Isaiah Pickett. You are a happy guy.
I am a happy guy.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be here with you, Larry. I'm really happy to be here with you and talk about this. It's an important time in our history as it relates to COVID-19 and trauma. And so I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, me too, Isaiah. I got to tell you, and I have to tell you something. When I was Googling you this today, just, you know, to read a little bit about you on your website, which is, as far as I can tell, is isaiahpickens.com. Is that the best place to go? Isaiahpickens.com.
Yeah.
Okay,
yes.
And when I went over there, and you're a good-looking guy, I'm going to give you that. You're a good-looking guy, okay? Your picture's there. Okay, but then it said, Isaiah Pickens, actor. Are you also an actor besides a clinical psychologist?
Well, that's a former life. So first of all, I am a real psychologist, but I've hosted a show before, and here's a little tidbit that I don't share a lot, but I actually had a role on The Wire on HBO way back
in
the day.
Get out. Omar. You weren't Omar, I can tell you that much. Oh, man, that I love that show. What role did you have? That's really great. That's so funny.
And it's great too, because, you know, part of what I believe is that so much of healing involves storytelling. And so
yeah.
I got into acting early on because I really wanted to deconstruct the human story. And then I ended up getting my PhD and doing it from the psychology perspective.
Wow. Well, when I read that, I wasn't sure it was you, but the thought crossed my mind when I saw the actor thing, that this makes you an even better speaker when you go out to school districts or whoever you're talking to, because that ability to act, you know, is just so great. I'm going to ask you again, what role did you have on The Wire, which is one of my favorite shows ever?
I didn't hear the question. So if you remember the dog fighting scene in season 3 with Method Man?
No, I don't. I'm embarrassed to say I don't. I did see it,
okay.
but I don't remember it. I apologize.
No, it's
yeah.
fine. People who watch the show know that scene. I'm the other guy. So it's me and
wow.
Method Man going back to back with one another, and we got some beef. Unfortunately, I'm the Mike Vick of the episode. Our pit bulls are fighting, but no animals were hurt. No, our animals were hurt in the process of filming this.
Right. It was such a great show as they went. That was just the best show. I watched every episode and probably saw them twice. And unfortunately, I do not remember. As I get older, I have less and less memory. All I remember is making the doll furniture. I remember the doll furniture. Right.
I'm glad you remember
Clark
that.
It was Clark Peters who was doing the doll furniture. Right.
Yeah.
And Omar, my man, Michael Kenneth Williams. Oh, my God. Did you meet him, Michael Kenneth Williams?
No, it was funny actually being on set. They put us in a space where it was pretty much just me, some extras, and Method Man, but they had to, you know, have a lot of security because Baltimore is a real city and there's a lot going on. They actually had to protect us from all the real stuff happening in Baltimore as well. And one of the things I love about the show is that it really does, I think, paint, especially season four, paints such a vivid picture of what so many of our students go through just trying to get to school every day. And especially with you starting the show with thinking about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on our black and brown students and how this isn't just the beginning. Because even before that, if you look at adverse childhood experiences and community-based traumas, historical traumas, many people within immigrant communities, within the black and Latino community, within LGBTQIA+ communities have been dealing with the cumulative impact of stress and trauma, and this is just exacerbating it.
Well, and just take it, boy, back in the same town. I can't remember what exactly happened in February or March when George Floyd was murdered. Okay?
Yeah.
And that was – thanks. We all saw that on TV. Okay? Can you – well, you can imagine the trauma of a black kid seeing that. And they all did, obviously. Okay?
Yeah.
On TV. Yeah. And I think that was before COVID. I think that was before we closed the schools in March. Okay,
yeah.
So you just keep adding this stuff up there, okay? And it's pretty rough on the, I'll say, the underrepresented minority groups. We got real challenges out there. And you are, by the way, absolutely a true psychologist, Dr. Pickens, PhD. I'm not a psychologist. I just play one on TV. No, that is not accurate. Okay. Right. You're a licensed clinical psychologist. And I just want to say your work with my good friends, I work with them a lot too, is presence learning. Okay. You did a seminar for them on September 29th. How'd that go? It was all about what we're going to talk about today, trauma-informed approaches to student mental health. But how'd that seminar go for presence learning?
It went great. Yeah, it went great. And presence learning, one of the things I love about them is that I really believe that they're increasing accessibility of these resources to communities wouldn't necessarily have access with the telehealth. And so we talked a lot about how do we really help all of our students, the ones who have the privilege of having access to treatment providers all the time and those who might not have that same access.
That's right.
So the seminar went great, and we were able to talk about a lot of that.
That's good. And presence learning, and we work a lot with them at our Consortium for Equity. Okay, and what you just said is exactly accurate. Okay, they are able to do the therapy. They were able to make therapy accessible to a hell of a lot more kids than would normally have it. And I think what they do is just great for schools. Everybody, it's presencelearning.com if you want to check that out. It's not an ad for them, but I just wanted to mention that. And again, Isaiah did that seminar for them. Okay, well, are you going out to schools these days? What are you hearing? Let's hear it from that angle.
Yeah.
What are you hearing? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so we're working in a lot of schools virtually right now. Our team, a big part of what we are seeing on the ground is really figuring out how to preserve the relationship when there's been so many transitions and so much uncertainty about the future. And when I say relationship, I'm talking about the teacher-student relationship, of course, but I'm also talking about the teacher and teacher, the collegial relationship, the principal with the teacher, and also the family with the school, because schools are more than just a place where you're seeing your kids. They're part of a community. And when the community in some way has been disrupted in the way that COVID-19 and the social justice and racial unrest that we've seen around injustice, it can be really damaging to some of those really important relationships. And when you're in a virtual space, kids just might not show up. And so we're seeing a lot of schools trying to figure out, how do I preserve this relationship, focus on their social emotional well-being, and really help them also achieve some of these academic goals that we need to have them achieve this year.
Right. Right, and I think that's actually a very good point, because we must strike that balance more so than ever. You know, and we always kind of did, but schools were there to educate. So I'll just say the academic kind of took precedence, if I may. Not that teachers don't care about their kids and all that sort of thing. But now academics is still important. Please don't misunderstand that. But the relationship, okay, of the kids and keeping them engaged, okay, is just so hard, especially for kids who have gone through these incredible traumas. All right, and I think and correct me if I'm wrong, Isaiah, but remote learning is a trauma in and of itself.
Yeah,
right?
Well, we would definitely say it's a huge stressor, and it can exacerbate the traumas that you're already experiencing, whether it's COVID-19, whether it's loss in terms of a family member, whether it's the cumulative impact of the economic distress that a lot of families are experiencing and neglect. And in fact, one of the troubling statistics that we've seen is that there's been a huge decrease in reports of child abuse. And we don't think it's because there's less child abuse. It's just fewer mandated reporters who can see into a kid's life when they come into school because they're, you know, in the virtual space. And so these are things we really are concerned about as we're moving into this different space.
Yeah. Where are you? Where do you live? Or where are you located?
So I'm based in Los Angeles. A lot of the schools that we work with are throughout the country. I'm on the East Coast in New York and some places in the middle of the country in Arkansas. And a big part of what we've seen as, you know, just a consistent theme throughout COVID-19 and during the reopening is significantly overstressed educators. And what we know about the reason why that's so important to keep in mind is because they're the ones who are supposed to create this consistent and safe environment for their students, even in a virtual space. And if they feel overwhelmed, it's hard for them to be able to manage all of the needs that so many students have, particularly in this time. In fact, there's a concept that we talk about in our field called secondary traumatic stress, and it speaks to the stress that comes from hearing the traumatic stories of others. And people can show even PTSD-like symptoms when they are constantly hearing the traumatic stories of others. And honestly, our teachers are hearing a lot of this because now kids are back in school and they want to release some of this to their teachers.
Right. It's amazing. What got you into this? Okay, just psychology, but also the education side.
Yeah, so I am
let me finish that sentence. Besides watching seasons 5 of The Wire where Chris Belusky became a teacher, besides that, okay, what got you into this?
I mean, that was so inspiring. I had tears in my eyes. I was like, this is the time. So I'm actually the son of a vice principal. That was my dad's retired vice principal, and my mother is a retired social worker in school. So I like to think of this as the family business. I grew up in a family, focused on education. And here's I know this sounds kind of corny, but I'm gonna say it anyway. I say it all the time. I grew up in a very close knit family, and for me that was such an important foundation for me to excel academically, for me to get involved in clubs and do all that. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to recreate that for other families who might have broken this for different reasons. And I know it sounds corny, but it's actually what inspired me to get into this work. And to because I started actually after I finished my work in New York, and that's where I got my PhD. I actually started as a child and family clinical psychologist, where I did a lot of family therapy, individual therapy, which is tremendously important. But then I started to think about how much important equally important changing systems are. And so I really wanted to figure out how can I support the school system holistically to really support the kind of structures and connections with the community and culturally responsive practices that really bring a lot of these evidence-based practices like trauma-informed, social-emotional learning, PBIS to life. And so that's really what got me into this work.
That doesn't sound corny. That doesn't sound – I'm going to argue with
well,
it.
You know,
corny.
Everyone has their Wire story where they were like, and I was down on my luck and nothing was working. And then all of a sudden I found a way, and that's just not, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking about The Wire now. I was just going to say you're not Bubbles. Come on, give me a break here, you know. Right, yeah, it doesn't sound corny at all, for goodness sakes. Okay, not at all. I love that story. When we talk about trauma-informed approaches, okay, what does that mean? Uh-huh. I mean, and let me just put it – trauma-informed, the kids, they're COVID, the kids are remote. Does that mean I'm now trauma-informed? What is a trauma-informed approach?
That's That's a great question. So SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, says that a trauma-informed approach has four R's, and there's some other principles, but I'll stick with the four R's to keep it simple. It's first realizing the widespread impact of trauma. What we know is that sometimes, and when we talk about trauma, we're talking about any event that makes a person feel like their life or the life of someone that they love is threatened in some way. And what can happen sometimes is that even as bad as some of these experiences are, people might hear the experience and it's so incongruent with what their belief of the world is that they don't actually realize how widespread it is. So if you tell them, you know, 60% of your class has experienced severe neglect and doesn't have food, they're like, no, there's no way that can happen in my class. And so they're not realizing the widespread impact of trauma. And so that already undermines people's sense of what we call psychological safety, the belief that they can manage the stress that's happening around them or reach out to someone to help them manage that stress. The second R is recognizing the impact of it. So there's a lot of signs that happen when kids have experienced trauma, things like they might avoid things they used to do. And avoidance might also look like substance use. It might look like behavior that's resistant in class. They might be aggressive more often in different things, or they may dissociate, which is pretty much a mental separation that looks like zoning out, but is really trying to get away from the thing that made you feel like you were in danger or threatened in some way. And then responding. The third R is responding in a way that is trauma-informed. So this means actually identifying what some of the trauma reminders might be, what some of the traumatic stress reactions are. That's what I just described in terms of some of those reactions. And then thinking about what are very specific tools to support the healing from that trauma. And then the final R is resist re-traumatization. I never know which R it is, but resist re-traumatization is the final piece. And sometimes, even with the best intent, our schools and our justice systems and our child welfare systems, they really want to help a kid, but the way that they're doing it is actually causing more harm. And so it's really about being able to resist re-traumatization in that process.
And so, Isaiah, let me ask you this. This is a tough question. I'll use somebody like me, okay? I'm a white guy, and I was a teacher. I taught social studies, okay? And when I was in teacher education, this stuff never came up. We had one course in educational psychology, and believe me, it had nothing to do with trauma. Believe me, okay? and believe me, the word guidance counselor never came up, okay? Nothing like that, okay? And my question is, okay, how can most teachers – really understand and learn the stuff? They were trained in something that is totally not this, all right? And what's the expectation that should be there, and how in heck can people like you get these points across and make them work in a typical classroom?
Yeah,
and
that's
I'll give
a
you.
Great,
by the way, if you can answer that, I'll give you another PhD from the University of Larry.
Well, the first thing is you watch all five seasons of The Wire. No, I'm joking. So the way that we really believe this is it has to be holistic, and that's why I love the work that me and my team at Eye Opening Enterprises does with presence learning. One of the things is being able to identify when students are in need. So. Sometimes we look at kids and we say, what's wrong with this kid, when we should be saying, what happened to this kid? And that simple reframe in terms of how you're seeing that the child actually prompts a different type of trajectory as it relates to supporting the kid. So instead of an out-of-class referral, it's now like, okay, maybe I should actually talk to the school mental health person or someone who might be able to get a service. And one of the things that we're doing with presence learning around this is we created a curriculum called Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times. And it's a 6-session curriculum for students to really engage a lot of these topics that we're talking about, whether it be trauma, whether it be understanding their own identity and in the course of racial justice and social justice and all these other issues. And so that's part of what an educator can do to really support it. The other part, though, is for the school to provide really concrete training and support for staff. So it is a part of their professional development and it's infused in the school. And so the other thing we do is we have a program called the Bridge Trauma-Informed Culturally Responsive Program. And that's actually the other half of that, where we actually do go in and we train staff and teachers on doing things such as, and I'll give you a couple of really concrete things you can do. Well, students who have experienced trauma can sometimes have activated what we call their survival brain. This is the amygdala that's responsible for processing aggression. It's the hippocampus that holds on to memories that were threatening before. And what it does is it sets off that fight, flight, or freeze response. And sometimes what educators are doing is the way that they're talking to their student is actually talking more to the learning brain, which is the frontal lobe and prefrontal cortex,
right.
Which is responsible
that was
for,
that's actually my point. Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah.
The learning brain.
Exactly.
Was, yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And so when you're talking to a survival brain, it wants safety. And so some things you can do to make the survival brain know it's safe is don't give as many directions. If you give a number of directions, it might confuse the kid, and that can be a trigger for them to go into that survival brain, go into that fight, flight, or freeze. The other thing you can do is give choice. Right. Part of what trauma does is it makes you feel vulnerable. You never want to feel vulnerable again. And the moment choice is taken away from you, even a simple choice like, you know, I need you to move. You can move to this seat or that seat. That gives the student the space to make a choice that empowers them and really counters a lot of what we see with the traumatic stress reactions. And so this is really important to infuse in the classroom.
Well, it's very, very complicated, and it brings up another question. We always look at these things as a trauma-informed approach, all right? But what do we need to tell the kids something to? The students themselves, and maybe not the littlest ones, they have a responsibility to themselves, and they may not even understand that, okay, that they do. Like Mrs. Johnson, I'm in trouble. But it might be hard to articulate that. How do we get the kids to understand, okay, that they have a role to play here too, and that the teachers and the support staff are there to help them, okay, not hurt them, that type of thing. And by the way, before we go down, you mentioned your company. I just wanted to say this: Eye Opening Enterprises with the letter I. EyeOpeningEnterprises.com is Isaiah's company, and I just wanted to give you just so everybody understood what that was. But what role does the student play, and how do we get them to understand that?
That's a great question. In fact, what you're sharing actually reminds me of a colleague of mine who actually worked in Bosnia after the war. And what he said is a lot of the teens there wanted to become doctors after the war. And he said, why did they want to become doctors? Well, a big reason why they wanted to become doctors is because they wanted to repair the damage that trauma had caused. And that's a part of the healing process, is giving students the space to repair the damage that trauma has caused. Maybe they lost someone to gun violence. Maybe they lost someone to COVID-19, experienced discrimination. And by being able to give them a healing space where they can, you know, talk to someone who may be dealing with the same thing and share with them how they're moving forward, or even being able to, write a letter to a younger kid who may have lost someone in the same way can be important for us to help students understand. But the other thing, I think, to your question, which is really important for students' role in this, is we have to give them some understanding of how their whole self plays a role in the way that they manage stress. And what I mean by that is sometimes we think of stress as too unidimensional, which is just there's, you know, things that stress us out, like homework and, you know, having to deal with traffic and all those things. And that's very true. But sometimes what we don't realize is that our most salient, our most important identities are a big part of what causes the stress. And so, as you said earlier, me as a black man, for those who don't know, I'm a black man, seeing George Floyd die on TV hit me in a way. And that's, we talk about that racial trauma because that's an important identity to me, and I hold that in a different way. The same way, parts of our identity as being a son or a daughter or LGBTQIA+ or immigrant, all these areas of our life play a role in how we manage stress and also what motivates us. What are the things we want to honor? What are the things that we want to inspire us? And so I think part of us really being able to help students find their power, as I was talking about with presence learning in terms of what we're doing, is being able to help them understand how their identities shape the way that they manage stress and shape the way that they navigate school, day and building, and then give them the tools to be able to engage that.
Yeah, and boy, that it really does. It does make a difference because I think a kid in an upscale white suburb is going to handle this stress differently, I'm not sure, than a kid who's an urban kid who's in remote learning right now. Okay, and there's difference, and we have to be well aware of that. It's just really, really, really frightening right now. What's going on out there? And let me ask you, go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to say real quick, I think part of what we also don't always realize is we don't need to have all the answers. That's what a culturally responsive approach is.
Oh, that's interesting.
And having cultural humility. It's very complicated, but I don't know if the, you know, wealthy white kid in the suburbs versus the urban kid will learn things differently. But if I ask them and I ask their family, then I'm opening up a space to learn how to do that. And that's a big part of what we have to get used to doing.
Yeah, and it, let me ask you that. I should have actually jumped on that before. The culturally responsive aspect of all this. I mean, that is key, and that's becoming, I hope, less a buzzword and more of something we're really working on. All right, but it is a challenge out there. There are not enough educators of color, be they black, brown, whatever. Okay, it's hard for people to understand what somebody else is going through. How put that culturally responsive piece into perspective here?
Yeah, for sure. So what I said with the trauma-informed piece is moving from what's wrong with this kid to what happened to this kid. When you add culturally responsive to it, it's also adding what is right with this kid. So stopping, you know, focusing on a frame that says, you know, what has this kid done to get to this place to survive, to be here today? And just having the frame of understanding all of the resources, all the strengths, and not making assumptions, but instead leaning in a way that's curious instead of judgmental. That's at the heart of a culturally humble approach. It's when you see behavior that doesn't make sense or that is challenging to you in the class, take a curious stance instead of a judgmental or punitive stance initially, so that you can start to understand the kid's story. And that's really at the heart of a culturally responsive approach, understanding their full story and bringing it into the classroom.
That's really, really important. Yeah, you know, in the way you said that, I just love that because I never quite thought of it that way. All right, that culturally responsive is really being a good thing. You're responding to the good in the person, okay, in terms of their culture, etc. That's a whole different perspective to look at it. I really like that. And to approach the cultural differences with a curiosity as opposed to an anger or what the hell are you doing there, kid? Okay.
Yeah.
As opposed to, that's right. Yeah. You know, this is kind of the way the neighborhood acts when they see something like that it's really different. And all of that, and I say, you know, you go into school districts, okay, which is key, all right? But I always ask this question, are you going into any schools of education? Okay, because that's where all this has to be taught. And I'll say what I said earlier. When I was it was a long time ago, admittedly. I'm telling you, the word special education, guidance counselor, go right down a whole list. These never even came up. I mean, it never even came up. Okay, and things have obviously changed since then, but I don't think enough. And I'm wondering what's going to grow out of this. And your stuff is great for what future teachers need to know. That's simple.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's something that we really, really want to build on. We really want education programs. We want psychology programs. Actually, psychology programs are actually just starting to talk about trauma-informed practice. So this is relatively new for everyone. And so we want teachers to have this as professional development as well as pre-service information. And we also want them to have access to resources that the students can use, like the Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times that Presence Learning is doing, that I just think is such a wonderful resource for so many students.
I was going to ask you about that. Just go into more detail about that, because it's the first time you mentioned the name of it. Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times. Talk what that is. It's just something you developed for Presence. Yeah, good.
Yeah, so Presence Learning and I, my team, we partnered together to create this curriculum for students. It's a 6-session curriculum that's about an hour each, where we focus on what are some of the key evidence-based resources and skills that we know we can support students to have during this time of uncertainty. And so we focus on how do we help them understand the way that they're thinking about the challenges they're facing. In fact, we talk about something called detective thinking, which is really a part of cognitive behavioral thinking, to help them look at their beliefs and their assumptions that show up and how it connects to a lot of the things we just talked about, like their identity and stress. And we talk about this concept called radical healing, which really believes in how do we start to heal from identity identity-based wounds, so wounds related to discrimination or our whole family or community experiencing a collective trauma or some sort of wounding. And then we also really integrate mindfulness because we really believe that creating space for awareness is so important for our students to be able to manage a time that is very uncertain. So we're really excited about this coming out very soon.
Right. Is it out yet? Actually, that's a good point. Is it out yet?
Yeah. So we are going to be actually training our first set of presence learning school psychologists next week. And so we expect in the next couple of weeks, this will be available to school districts around the country.
Great. And what you're doing with it, again, it's called Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times. That's what you're going to train teachers to teach kids how to do that. It's a curriculum that teachers can use to teach kids. Yeah.
No. Yeah, so actually we're training – so Presence Learning has a wonderful telehealth platform. We're training all of their therapists to do this. So their therapists will actually do these with small groups of students of 3 to 5 students who participate. So, we're really
so it's direct to the kids. It's direct to the kids. It's not
professional development.
That's where I was mixed up.
No. The Bridge Trauma-Informed Culture Responsive Program for my company is professional development directly to teachers. This Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times is so aligned because it's directly to the students. So we're really trying to have a holistic approach in addressing these issues.
That's great. It's a double-edged sword. I love that. So the Presence Learning, okay, is direct for the kids, presencelearning.com, Finding Your Power in Uncertain Times. And then to get to yours for educators, Dr. Pickens, is it eyeopeningenterprises.com? Is that
the best
place?
That's correct. And that's letter I,
openingenterprises.com. I was just going to say that, it's the letter I, eyeopeningenterprises. I like that, self-reflection, so to speak, eyeopeningenterprises.com. Okay, that's really, really cool. This is good stuff. All right. And Isaiah, I hope you come back on over the next few months and we'll talk about all this because there's scary stuff. And I think, you know, politics aside, the COVID's getting worse, okay? And I said, Boston just had to close down, okay?
Yeah.
They thought they were going to go in. They just literally closed down. You were in L.A. I don't, probably the same thing's going to happen, I hope not, in the L.A. schools, okay? And it's just going to get crazier and crazier, and it's really bad for the underrepresented groups, the kids who are in poverty, let's just use that line, okay? And you know, they can't afford all this stuff, all right? And it's brutal. It's brutal out there.
Yeah.
So, this is really good stuff. Again, folks, eyeopeningenterprises.com to reach Isaiah directly. He'll tell you about The Wire, okay? All right, and Method Man, all right, which is cool stuff. And
I have a question for you. Did I get my PhD?
Yes, sir.
You said, you know, I will earn another PhD.
The University of Larry will be in touch. You haven't written your thesis yet. It's a 140-character thesis. And we put them on Twitter. Okay.
Okay.
It's great. Okay, funny stuff, Isaiah. But I'm telling you, the stuff you're doing is really, really incredible. Dr. Isaiah Pickens, everybody. Thank you, my man. You're a good guy. Now you've gotten me. I think I'm going to tell my wife we need to watch The Wire again. I can't wait to see season 3. Okay, I'm going to. We love that show. I just loved it. Okay, we'll get back into it.
It's worth another watch. I think I might watch it again.
Oh man, it is the if nobody if you have if anybody I'm just telling you this if you haven't seen The Wire, do it now. Okay, about 6 seasons of the best TV you'll ever see. Okay, and
right.
Michael Kenneth Williams stars his first big role as Omar. Right, unbelievable that guy. All right, good stuff.
Amazing.
Isaiah, thanks a million. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Larry. I look forward to next time. I'm going to get
we're
that
We're
going to
do a next five. Thank you, my friend. Have a good day. Stay
you
safe,
too.
By
Thank
the way.
You.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Isaiah Pickens, everybody. I with the letter I. Eyeopeningenterprises.com. And for the thing that they're offering for students through Presence Learning is presencelearning.com. And Presence Learning is a company that believes in equity and access. Okay? And by the way, I'll just segue right there, ace-ed.org, our American Consortium for Equity and Education. They're a part of it. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Can't thank you enough for listening. Isaiah, can't thank you enough for being my guest. Everybody, stay safe. Have a good day.